Brilliant novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With the growth of QAnon, conspiracy theories, and rampant misinformation about COVID-19, there have been many times in the past year when it's been easy to see the very real dangers of embracing false beliefs. But believing things that aren't true is far more common than most of us could imagine, and it's not all bad. Shankar Fadantam is the host of Hidden Brain, a public radio program and podcast that explores life's unseen patterns and can help listeners understand the world and even their own behavior in new ways. His latest book is Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain, and he is with me on the line now. Hello, Shankar.
Hi, Charity. Thank you so much for having me on your program.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And the book is coming out at such an interesting moment because in the past year, many Americans have literally lost their lives because they or others in their communities couldn't or wouldn't face the reality of COVID-19. Clearly, you were working on this book well before the pandemic began, but how have the events of the past year influenced your feelings on this topic?
Yeah, so it's a fascinating question, Charity, because I think all of us look out at the world and we see examples of self-deception gone awry and all the terrible things that come from delusional beliefs. Our response to the COVID-19 pandemic, the fact that, you know, as a nation, we put our heads in the sand and sort of didn't act as quickly as we should, the ways in which many people have responded to the pandemic by, you know, not wearing masks or not following public health guidelines. All of these have totaled up to an extraordinary tragedy in the United States and in many countries around the world. At the same time, I think it's useful to flag that just because we see numerous examples of self-deception causing us harm, it's inaccurate to assume that all self-deceptions basically have the same effect. In many ways, I think we tend to recognize delusions when they are negative delusions, and we tend to recognize delusions when they are other people's delusions. We tend not to do that very much with our own self-deceptions, and we tend not to see the ways in which self-deception might be able to help us. In terms of COVID in particular, let me give you the smallest of examples on the positive side of the ledger. If you had told me a year ago that the pandemic was going to last a year, I'm not sure I would have really been able to stand the idea. But at every stage of the pandemic, I told myself that liberation was a month away, that there was going to be a light at the end of the tunnel a month away. And in fact, I'm still telling myself there's going to be a light at the end of the tunnel a month from now. That might or might not be true, but it's the kind of self-deception that has helped me stay functional, helped me stay positive.
Let's talk about you a little bit before we dig into some of the stories that you share in the book. You describe yourself in the book as being a realist, or thinking that you were a realist growing up, being very skeptical of others' beliefs. Tell me a little bit about young Shankar and how you saw the world.
Well, I would say that I've always prided myself on being a logical and rational person. I was drawn to science from a very young age. I've been a science journalist for, you know, the vast majority of my career. I truly believe in the importance of reason and logic, and believe that thinking scientifically and learning to think scientifically is really important in both our personal lives as well as in the lives of our societies. The thing that has disconcerted me, I would say, in the last, 15 or 20 years, is the numerous examples I see around me where logical thinking and rational thinking do not accomplish the goals that they are setting out to accomplish. Let me give you just one example. Think about the research into the phenomenon of climate change. By now, the vast majority of the scientific community believes in the reality of climate change and believes that humans are the cause of climate change, and also believes that there are going to be catastrophic consequences as a result of climate change. Now, there have been a huge number of studies that have been published in very reputable scientific journals laying out the scale and magnitude and consequences of climate change. But if you look at who these studies have convinced, these studies have largely convinced people who already believe in the reality of climate change. They've done very little to convince people who are skeptics. And if you believe that logic and reason are all there is to human nature, you would have to expect that the 677 study would finally make a dent in the beliefs of people who don't believe in climate change. But of course, we find that's not the case. The people who didn't believe in the first 676 studies are not going to change their minds when the 677 study comes out. And the book really that I've written is a meditation on why this is, how it happens, and how in some ways we can use the self-deceiving brain to our ends, in some ways to serve the goals of reason and logic.
With Hidden Brain, you do such a wonderful job doing a deep dive into the scientific research and then helping a layperson like myself understand what you're talking about. You communicate about this research that for so long has really been kind of locked behind the walls of academia or published in journals. And even when it makes it into the public press or the popular press, it's so watered down that, you know, we get a kernel of it and not the whole understanding. Was there a moment in your career as a journalist or just in your life that made you want to find a new way to help people understand what we know and what we're discovering?
Yeah, I've always been fascinated by science. And first of all, thank you for the kind words that you just said about what we do at Hidden Brain. We try very hard to try and find interesting research and interesting ideas, often being published by academic researchers, and then trying to work very, very hard to make those ideas accessible, to make them germane to people's lives. You know, some years ago, Charity, someone gave me a really interesting thought experiment. You know, we talk all the time about income inequality and wealth inequality. And those things are really important to talk about. But this person said, have you ever thought about the idea that we have inequality in terms of access to ideas, access to information? Imagine for a second that every last person on the planet today knew as much as the best educated person on the planet today. Imagine we didn't have disparities of knowledge. What kind of a world would we live in? What kind of a planet would we inhabit? And the thought experiment was wonderful because it actually showed me that in some ways, the greatest challenge when it comes to knowledge is not in advancing the frontier of knowledge, but in making sure that we reduce some of the disparities that we have in knowledge around the world. And I think that's the mission that I've chosen to pursue at Hidden Brain with a very talented team of people. We try and in some ways close the knowledge gaps by trying to make important and interesting ideas as widely accessible and as comprehensible as possible to the largest number of people.
Let's dig into this book a little bit. You start the book with a story that I think a lot of diehard, longtime public radio listeners are familiar with because it was on This American Life. It's been on Hidden Brain. A story about the Church of Love. But for people who don't know and aren't quite as public radio diehards as those others, explain what the Church of Love is.
Sure. So the Church of Love was not really a church, and arguably it was not really about love. It was really a con that was set up many, many years ago by a balding middle-aged man in a small Midwestern town. And he was a writer, and his name was Donald Lowry. And over the course of many years in the 60s, 70s, 80s, he invented various characters, mostly young women, whom he called angels. And then he wrote love letters in their voices to thousands of men across the United States. In its heyday, the Church of Love had as many as 30,000 members who were receiving love letters from these fictitious angels. What was remarkable about the con was that over the course of years and sometimes decades, many of the people receiving the letters, the members of the Church of Love, fell in love with their correspondents. They believed they were corresponding with real women. They believed that they had found their soulmates. Some of them even signed mystic marriage pledges, pledging to be married to the person whom they were supposedly corresponding with. And the most astonishing part of the entire story is that when Donald Lowry, the con man, was finally charged with mail fraud and put on trial, several members of the Church of Love showed up at his trial to defend him. And I found this totally astonishing. You know, why, when the con is revealed, why would the Marx show up to defend the con man? And in some ways, it was the starting point for this book in my explorations of how self-deception works and how sometimes people will go to great lengths to protect and defend their self-deceptions.
What made you want to go talk to one of those Marx, one of the people who really were victims of this con?
Just because I think at a psychological level, the story was so fascinating, Charity. I mean, why is it that when you realize that you've been a victim of a con, why would you seek to defend the con? Why would you seek to keep the con going? Now, I should clarify that this was not the reaction of all the members of the Church of Love.
Right.
Many of them responded with anger when they discovered that they had been cheated. Some of them said, well, this was fine. It was just a fun game to pretend that we were corresponding with these fictitious people. But there were some people who genuinely believed that they had found their soulmates.
Well, and had given thousands and thousands of dollars. I mean, over $30,000 in some cases, to this organization. So
that's right.
Yeah, I mean, there was the emotional toll and the deceit, but also they were bilked for money and gifts and all kinds of things.
That's right. So the premise of the love letter scheme was that on a periodic basis, the women who were writing to the men would ask the men to provide what they termed love offerings. So these were typically not described as, you know, pay for play, as in, you know, you send me 10 bucks and I'll send you a love letter. They were described as saying, you know, the angel would say, I really need help with, you know, getting some new clothes or, you know, getting seeds for my garden or various other sort of general household expenses. And the men who were corresponding were expected to act, you know, chivalrously and sort of support these women in some ways. And over the course of years, Donna Lowry, the con man, eventually, you know, extracted millions of dollars from these thousands of people across the United States. So very clearly there was a financial scheme and there was a mechanism to extract money from the members. But what I found as I started to talk with some of these members is that the love letters, in fact, had played a very powerful role in their lives. When Donald Lowry was put on trial, several of the members of the Church of Love said that the love letters had kept them from alcoholism, from in some ways, from their lives disintegrating. A couple of members, in fact, said the love letters had kept them from suicide. And it prompted me to ask the disturbing question, disturbing for me as a logical, rational person, is it possible that in some cases, at least some of the time, self-deception can actually do you some good?
So
that
did,
was the starting
the
point
good
for my conversation.
Possibly outweigh the bad in that situation. We're going to dig much more thoroughly into that story and many others in just a moment. I'm talking to Shankar Vedantam. He is the host of Hidden Brain, a public radio program and podcast, and he has just published Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. This is Talk of Iowa.
The Iowa legislature is in session.
Let's just go around. We got a lot of people.
There are proposals for constitutional amendments, education, taxes, the budget, and many policy bills.
So what needs to be fixed?
Our weekly podcast, Under the Golden Dome, is following the session.
I want to thank you for your consideration of this important legislation.
I'm John Pemble. Subscribe to the podcast or hear Under the Golden Dome on our website, iowapublicradio.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Shankar Vedantam. He is the host of Hidden Brain, a public radio program and podcast, and he's just published his latest book. It's called Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. It explores some of the many ways that humans embrace false beliefs, which is a phenomenon that is far more common than most of us would imagine. And Shankar argues that it's not all bad. So, Shankar, before the break, we were talking about the Church of Love, this con where a man created all of these fictitious women and men all over the country corresponded with these women, fell in love with them, sent them offerings. And of course, this man bilked them out of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars is what it added up to. But you were surprised to learn that many of these men who had been conned showed up at the trial of this con artist to defend the Church of Love. And you decided to interview a number of the men who had been involved. And the story that you share most deeply and is really most intriguing to me as well is about Joseph Enriquez. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Yeah, so Joseph Enriquez was a remarkable figure, and I grew to really like him in many ways. You know, when I first heard his story, I reacted the way that I think many people would react, which is that he was one of the members of the Church of Love who had received letters from a young woman named Pamela, and over the course of years had fallen in love with Pamela. And when the trial eventually took place, Joseph was one of the people who showed up at the courtroom and testified on behalf of the defense. And even now, you know, years after the Church of Love has ended, Joseph continues to believe that his relationship with Pamela, with this fictitious woman whom he was corresponding with, was one of the most important relationships in his life. And initially, I think when I heard his story, I reacted the way most people would react. I would say, you know, I thought that Joseph was a foolish person, that Joseph had been taken in, that he was an easy mark. But as I slowly came to understand his story, I started to understand his story from the inside out rather than from the outside in. I came to see all the ways in which Joseph's life had been constrained, that his options had been limited, and how the love letters appeared to him in some ways to be a lifeline. And Joseph's story in some ways, I think, is sort of the starting point for a larger idea in the book, Charity, which is that all of us in some ways can do without delusions and self-deceptions when our lives are going well, when things are going great, when our families are going great, when our health is wonderful, when our jobs are wonderful. We have no need for self-deceptions because, in fact, life is wonderful. But take for a moment when those things are taken away from you, when suddenly your life takes a downturn, and it turns out that all of us become instantly more prone to reaching for beliefs that will comfort us, reaching for beliefs that will soothe us. The story of Joseph in the Church of Love might be an extreme version of this, but all of us have seen examples of this in our own lives. A few months ago, let me give you a story from my own life. I was traveling a few hours away from my home in Washington, D.C., and I suffered a retina detachment. For those of you who are not familiar, for the listeners who are not familiar with a retina detachment, the retina in some ways is the screen behind your eyes that allows your eyes in some ways to pick up light signals to be able to see. And when the screen comes off its hinges, when the retina detaches, you can essentially go blind in one eye relatively quickly and that you can't retrieve sight in that eye subsequently. So this happened while I was several hours away from my home. I didn't have access to any of my usual eye doctors. I finally found an eye doctor in a city that I'd never visited in my life, and he kindly opened his practice for me at 9 o'clock in the night. He diagnosed me and told me that I had to be rushed into surgery within minutes or I was going to lose my eye. Now, I didn't have a chance to get a second opinion. I didn't have a chance to look up doctor reviews. I just trusted this man because at this point, he was my only lifeline. He was all that I had. Now, as it turned out, he was a brilliant doctor, a wonderful physician. He ended up saving my eye, and I'm profoundly grateful to him for doing that. But I've asked myself this question. Let's assume in that moment that he had not actually been a brilliant doctor. Let's say that he had been a charlatan. Is it any less likely that I would have put my trust in him, that I would have put my faith in him? And the answer is no, I would have still trusted him. I would have still put my faith in him because at that point, my faith and my trust was not being shaped by him. My faith and trust was shaped by my own vulnerability, my own fears of what was happening to my eye. And in some ways, that's the larger lesson in the book, which is when we are confronted by great vulnerabilities, by threats, by uncertainties, by anxieties that we cannot control, many of us become much more willing at that point to put our faith and trust in explanations that might defy the rational. Sometimes that can lead us astray, but sometimes those explanations can, in fact, be very useful to us. There's the old aphorism, you know, there are no atheists in the foxhole. And the idea, again, is that when you have bullets whizzing over your head, it's very easy for all of us to turn to beliefs that can soothe us, that can comfort us.
You write a great deal about the placebo effect, which we know is real. I mean, somebody can give you fake medicine or a fake treatment and it can help you heal. And you give some really powerful examples of how strong the placebo effect can be. And I recall a program that you did where you dove even deeper. I remember a conversation mm-hmm. with a woman who was cured by a placebo in a mm-hmm. study, and then mm-hmm. told that it was a placebo, and mm-hmm. taken off the placebo, she got sick again and begged to be put on the placebo again. and then it worked again, even though she fully understood that it wasn't real medicine. So this placebo effect can be so incredibly powerful. And it's a great example of how embracing a false belief can have really wonderful effects on us. But it also, you explore some of the ethical problems in that, because mm-hmm. while doctors may understand the placebo effect, they can't ethically pretend to perform surgeries on people because they mm-hmm. know that probably it will help them even if they're not doing anything.
Yeah, it's a profoundly difficult question, Charity. In fact, both in the book and in the Hidden Brain podcast, we explore the idea of placebo surgeries, not just someone taking a pill, but someone, can you actually get a sham surgery and experience some of the effects of the surgery than if you got real surgery? And it turns out that surgery can also have a placebo effect. In fact, when we think about the placebo effect, we think about fake treatment, but really the placebo effect, I think, is part of a much larger idea, which is that when we are sick, when we are feeling vulnerable, we go to a doctor. But part of what we're doing when we go to a doctor is not just looking for medical care. All of us know doctors who are very good at what they're doing, very skilled in as physicians. They're very knowledgeable in what they do. But we come out from those doctors' offices not feeling like we've been taken care of. And all of us have also been to doctors and physicians who really know what it is to extend compassion to us when we are suffering, when we are frightened, when we are lonely. And we all experience those things as we experience, you know, medical setbacks. When we think about the placebo effect, we often think about the doctors as simply making up something or making up a cure. But the truth is, all of us, even when we're getting real treatments, real medications, real surgeries, all of those also have an element of the placebo effect. Part of the reason we are responding to treatment is because we believe that we're going to respond to treatment. We believe we are getting the ideal kinds of treatment. We believe that we have been taken care of. So in some ways, the demarcation between what is real and what is not real turns out to be somewhat murky. Even when we're getting quote unquote real treatments, part of the benefits of those treatments arise from our own beliefs in the doctor, our own beliefs about the power of medicine to heal us. Now, this raises profoundly difficult ethical questions, because you can make an argument on both sides of the equation. You can say that if doctors and hospitals actually have a mechanism to help people, they should be doing all they can to help people, because that's what doctors and hospitals should do. And if people's faith that they're going to get better, their belief in the medical system, if that's part of the reason that they get better, then it's the obligation of doctors and hospitals to take full advantage of that, to actually help people, you know, realize the full benefits of the placebo effect. Now, the flip side of that is, if doctors now start telling patients and doctors what they want to hear and start reaching for sham therapy or fake treatments, is that going to undermine the faith that people have in medicine? And even more, is it going to undermine the trust that patients have in doctors? It's a profoundly difficult question. And I think the way we resolve that question is we resolve that question by simply saying, you know, doctors should never lie to patients. Doctors should never tell their patients anything that's not completely accurate. But what that effectively means is that, in effect, at an implicit level, doctors and patients still take advantage of the placebo effect all the time. They simply just can't talk about it explicitly. This is the bind that I think we have put ourselves in, because we've created a system that says self-deception is always bad. Self-deception should always be abhorred and be pushed away. Whereas in reality, there might be situations where, at least in some cases, self-deception can have useful effects.
One of the other ways that you illustrated this was really by exploring the power of positive thinking. And part of that plays into the placebo effect because, for example, somebody who is going through cancer treatment and believes that they are getting better in spite of maybe evidence that they are not, they are more likely to get better. So you find that there is this positive effect of embracing positive beliefs, mm-hmm. although that can go a little too far as well. I mean, I think we probably right. can all think of people in our lives who believe that they're just about to get rich and therefore should take this mm-hmm. chance, or, you know, things like that, mm-hmm. where mm-hmm. you're like, you're completely blinded to reality and yes. you need to see what's going on here. So that feels like a very fine line that all of us walk.
Yes. And all of us do walk this, and all of us, I think, have to reconcile this for ourselves. And it might be that there's not a one-size-fits answer for everyone. You know, having a sense of meaning and purpose in life is associated with having a longer, richer, and happier life. Now, can meaning and purpose sometimes be associated with things that are crazy ideas and things that are ridiculous, you know, ridiculous beliefs or even cults? Yeah, they can. So it can be taken to a point where actually it can cause us harm, it can cause other people harm. But does that mean that meaning and purpose are always a bad thing? So I think this is the dilemma, and you've laid your finger exactly on it. The dilemma is that sometimes our beliefs have a powerful role to play in ensuring our well-being, but sometimes the very same beliefs can lead us astray. So if you're someone who's focused only on the upside, you would sort of say, let's embrace all self-deceptions and all self-delusions because look at all the good things they do. If you're someone focused only on the downside, you say exactly the opposite. Look at all the terrible things that self-deception and delusion can do. Let's always guard against it. The book that I've written just now, along with my co-author Bill Metzler, is trying to make a more nuanced point. It's saying sometimes self-deception can be good for you. To throw it out entirely would sort of be to throw out the baby with the bathwater. Sometimes you want to be judicious in how much self-deception you allow yourself to indulge in, but to throw it all away might not be a good idea. Especially, I think, when it comes to mental health, I think this is especially true, because for a long time, people believed that mental health involved seeing the world accurately, and mental illness involved seeing the world with a delusional pessimism. Over the last 20 or 30 years, many researchers have turned that idea on their head. It turns out that people who are suffering from depression and anxiety sometimes are better able to see the world clearly. They're able to see the world in more realistically than people who are quote unquote mentally healthy. And people who are in some ways mentally well-adjusted are often the people who are delusionally able to see their world, to see their lives through an optimistic frame, through rose-tinted glasses. And so in some ways, transitioning from mental illness to mental health doesn't mean you're transitioning from reality to delusion. It means just the opposite. You're actually transitioning from being able to see the world. You know, people with mental illness are seeing the world, more realistically, but being mentally healthy involves in some ways seeing the world more delusionally. This raises a dilemma. Which do you choose? Do you want to choose mental health, even if that means that you're actually, you know, seeing the world delusionally? Or do you want to choose mental illness with all of the suffering that it entails because it sometimes means that you're seeing the world more clearly? It's a terrible dilemma.
I just saw a study released the other day on the pandemic that was really interesting, showing that looking at people's political beliefs along with their beliefs about COVID-19, that Republicans, people who affiliate as Republicans, tend to underestimate the dangers of COVID-19, but people who affiliate as Democrats tend to overestimate the dangers of COVID-19 and take more precautions than would likely be necessary. And it's such a this year has been such an interesting study in watching our biases play out in practice and with incredibly high stakes. So what do you think we can take away from that?
Well, what I take away from that is that the loyalties that we have to our groups is extraordinarily powerful. And in our evolutionary past, there were good reasons to have such loyalty. So the reason our brains are drawn to the comfort of the tribe, the comfort of our groups, today those groups might be political parties rather than, you know, ethnic tribes. But the reason we're drawn to those is that our brains in our evolutionary past found benefit in standing with the group and standing with the tribe. This is why in so many ways we are willing to look past the facts, to ignore the facts in service of the loyalty to our tribes, because again, in our evolutionary history, this stood us in very good stead. So imagine for a second that you're not a human being right now, but you're transported back millions of years to the past and you have to make a choice. Do I follow the group, or do I follow what I believe to be the reality that I'm seeing? Now, it turns out that even if you were seeing reality clearly, in many cases in our evolutionary past, it made sense to stick with the group because the group, sticking with the group, offered you comfort, it offered you security, it offered you safety. And so those algorithms in some ways are built into our minds and built into our brain today, telling us that even when we're confronting something that's a deadly pandemic, we might be better advised to follow the research or the insights of scientists who are telling us, here's what we should do, here's how we should behave. We become more likely to follow the impulses of our tribe. So it's not surprising in some ways that what you're saying is that Democrats might be more afraid than the data suggest, Republicans might be less afraid than the data suggest, because both those things can be explained by the fact that Republicans and Democrats are both hewing to the dictates of their tribe. They're hewing to the dictates of their group. They're driven in some ways by the loyalty of their groups. Part of what we do in a situation like this, I think, is to ask the question, knowing that the human brain is prone to these vulnerabilities, is prone to the loyalty and the tugs of loyalty of the group, how do we take advantage of that as we're trying to spread the message of science? I think the error that we make is to say, just because something is accurate, that's all we need to do in order to convince people to follow what is accurate. I think the better message would be, how do we take advantage of the self-deceiving brain? How do we take advantage of group loyalties now to nudge people, to guide people towards the towards what's logical, towards what's rational?
Well, we will explore some of those questions a little more deeply in just a couple of minutes. We have to take a short break, but stay with us, Shankar. I'm talking with Shankar Vedantam. He's the host of Hidden Brain, a public radio program, which, of course, you can listen to on Iowa Public Radio. It's also a podcast that explores life's unseen patterns and can help listeners understand the world and their own behavior in new ways. His latest book is Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain, co-written with Bill Messler. And we will continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
If you love this podcast and IPR, you probably know that it's fueled by listener dollars. Hi, I'm Rick Brewer, a talk show producer at Iowa Public Radio, and part of my job is connecting with Iowans who have stories to tell. When you contribute to IPR, you help make that possible. Membership contributions make up 57% of IPR's budget. That's huge and amazing. So do your part to support the podcast and programs you enjoy. Go to iowapublicradio.org and tap the red donate button. Thank you.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with Shankar Vedantam. He is the host of Hidden Brain. You can listen to Hidden Brain on Iowa Public Radio at 6 a.m. on Saturday mornings or Sundays at noon. It's also a podcast. And he's just published Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. And Shankar, we were talking about some of the many ways that, we can deceive ourselves, the fact that really all of us probably embrace things that just aren't true. And sometimes that can be positive and sometimes that can be terribly, terribly negative. And I think we can all think of examples of negative situations where people believe things that aren't true. So how do we harness this in a positive way? I don't want to purposely believe something that I don't think is real.
Well, I'm not sure that's actually true. I think there are probably things that you do believe that are not real that actually are very functional to you. And let me give you a couple of examples. You know, for those of us who are old enough to remember, in the days shortly after the 9/11 attacks, many people sensed that there was something very different in the country. A lot of the partisan animosity sort of disappeared. All of a sudden, Republicans and Democrats stopped thinking of themselves as Republicans and Democrats. They started thinking of themselves as Americans. And they said, you know, we were attacked as Americans. We need to respond as Americans. Now, what happened in that moment was not that the delusional beliefs of partisanship were replaced by logic and reason. What happened really was that people replaced one set of beliefs about one set of tribes with another set of beliefs about another larger tribe. Right. So in other words, rather than think of yourself as the tribe of Democrats or the tribe of Republicans, you started thinking of yourself as being part of the tribe of Americans. You know, Hollywood has played with this idea for a long time, you know, where nations fight with one another all the time. But the moment the aliens start showing up and start firing at us, all of a sudden we realize, you know, maybe we shouldn't fight one another because we're actually part of the same larger group. And that actually is an important insight when it comes to overcoming many of the divisions that we see in our society or see around the world. We often assume that the way to dismantle those delusions or the delusional beliefs that tribe sometimes produces is by making logical arguments against it. And I'm not for a second suggesting that isn't useful to do. That is useful to do. It is valuable to do. But in some ways, it might be more effective to basically give people larger loyalties that the hidden brain or the unconscious mind can in some ways hook itself into. So if we buy the idea that our brains are prone to connecting us to tribes, and those the conflicts between tribes can produce unnecessary conflict and war between groups or between nations, one way to overcome that is not just by preaching how illogical those loyalties are, but to preach the value of a larger loyalty, to say there is something that actually builds, that actually connects us together, that binds us together. Focusing on that can be a way to dismantle some of the disagreements and conflicts that we have. And I would argue this is an example of the way in which you can use the self-deceiving brain in some ways to limit the problems of the self-deceiving brain. Rather than approaching a problem with logic, you're actually taking advantage of the propensity of the brain to form loyalties to group by redefining the loyalties differently and saying, here's what you should actually care about.
Which you see politicians trying to do all the time, trying to ignite that unity.
Right. And so politicians are sort of doing twin things, right? So when they're trying to win an election, you're trying to basically rally your own party behind you, and you're trying to sharpen the divisions between your party and another party. But the truth is, we also need politicians who are basically pointing us in some ways to our larger group loyalties, who are pointing us to say, you know, don't think of yourself as Republicans or Democrats, think of yourself as Americans. And perhaps even at a larger scale, don't think of yourself as, you know, Americans or Mexicans or Canadians, think of yourselves as being citizens of the world. Think of yourself as being members of of a single planet. So there are different ways in which you can construct groups, and different constructions of those groups prompt people to behave differently to one another. Now, I would argue that, you know, believing in the nation and being patriotic about your nation, this produces immense goods. There are very valuable things that come from the fact that we all believe that we're part of a great nation. But anyone who looks at the history of the last 100 years can also see all kinds of terrible things that come from nationalism, that come from this belief that we have, that the lines that we have drawn in the sand between nations mean something that's real, that's worth fighting for, that's worth defending, that's worth killing each other for. And it's worth, in some ways, in those moments, reconsidering whether there might be larger ways we can construct the idea of the groups that we subscribe to, the groups to whom we have loyalties.
We, of course, are seeing a lot of racial tension, racial strife in our country right now. And we see people aligning themselves with their tribes. And that, you know, as you said, that's something that we instinctively do. And I remember there was a show that you did in 2016. It was fairly early or late in 2016 or early in 2017. It was after the election of Donald Trump, where you focused on research about people being willing to express racist beliefs and how the social norms of whether or not you could say something racist had just shifted dramatically in a matter of weeks. And I remember Aziz Ansari did a monologue on Saturday Night Live right after President Trump was elected, where he said, hey, apparently, a lot of you were pretending not to be racist, and we didn't know it, and it would be okay if you pretended not to be racist again, because I'm tired of getting shouted at on the street. So, you know, there are so many different levels to this, but this tribalism that has caused so much hate and so much hurt, when we try to reverse these social norms and return to a place where you're not supposed to be overtly racist, how can we do that? What can we learn from what we've seen to harness that to go the other direction?
Yeah. So one thing that I will flag that I think is a useful way to think about this is, I think it's a mistake to imagine that there's something real and there's something fake, right? To sort of say, you know, these are the real views people had, and Donald Trump liberated people to express their real views. And the reason I sort of push back on that is that I think at some level, it's all constructed. all of our views, all of our opinions, these are all constructed, shaped by social norms, shaped by culture, shaped by upbringing in all kinds of complex ways. To ask what's real and what's not real is actually a very difficult question, because in some ways it's all constructed. But I think the example that you made is so potent, because it actually points to the absolute importance of leadership in allowing certain things to become common currency and keeping things from becoming common currency. I think it's really important, for example, for our leaders to talk to one another and to talk to us in ways that are kind, that are ways that are compassionate. And in modeling that kind of behavior, you're more likely to see people model that behavior in response. Now, asking, is it fake that people are modeling kind behavior because their leader is modeling kind behavior? I think in some ways that question is a mistake, because in some ways all of our behavior is constructed. Some time ago, Charity, I was reading this interesting, I don't know if you're familiar with this, it's the puzzle of the ship of Theseus. And it comes to us from Greek philosophy. Theseus was a great Greek warrior. And when he finally returned from his travels and adventures, his ship was maintained in the harbor almost as a museum piece to remember this great hero. And as the ship slowly rotted and disintegrated over the years and decades, you know, the rotten planks were taken out and they were replaced with new planks until eventually, you know, the entire ship of Theseus was replaced with new parts. So all of the planks were new, all of the pieces were new, all of the parts were new. And Plato and other philosophers have asked this question, you know, is it still the same ship if in fact all of the parts of the ship of Theseus are replaced? Is it still the ship? Now, you can actually take this a second level deeper and say, what if you took all of the old parts of the ship of Theseus and reassembled them into a new ship? Is that new ship now the real ship of Theseus? And is the ship that's sitting in the harbor in some ways a fake ship? And the reason I mention all of this is, of course, when we think about ourselves, our biological, you know, bodies, but also our mental bodies, both our biology and our minds in some ways are like the ship of Theseus. They're being constructed and reconstructed all the time. There are parts of me that didn't exist a few years ago that have been replaced by new parts. I don't think of myself as being a different person. I think of myself as being the same person that I was, you know, 25 years ago or 45 years ago. But I know, certainly at a biological level, that's not the case. The cells in my body have regenerated. But it's also true about my mind. The views that I've had have been shaped and reshaped over the time. In some ways, this goes into deep philosophical waters. You know, the Buddhists would argue that the sense of self itself is an illusion or a delusion, that in some ways, all of it is a construction. When you think of it in this way, and perhaps I've taken us into much deeper waters than you intended with your question about free speech, I think the question really is not so much, is one version real and is one version fake, but to ask, assuming that it's all constructed, how do we construct our lives, our cultures, our norms in a way that lead us to harmony, to working well with other people, rather than leading us to conflict?
There have been so many moments. I am a huge fan of Hidden Brain. You've probably picked up on that by now. But there have been so many moments over the years when, in response to something that's going on in our country or in our world, there's something that I don't understand, and then you'll release an episode on the podcast, maybe a rerun, that really helps break it down and helps me understand why people are behaving in the way that they do, or why I'm behaving in the way that I am. And there have been many times when I, you know, post on my social media and say, everybody needs to listen to this. We need to understand why we're doing this. But at the same time, I know most people aren't going to spend an hour unpacking, you know, their own motivations and the motivations of those around them. Do you sometimes feel like you are preaching to the choir, that the people who want to hear this are the people that maybe don't need it quite as badly as others?
That's a really interesting question. I do think that people who are drawn to a show like Hidden Brain are probably drawn to sort of thinking about their inner worlds and thinking about how their inner worlds speak to the outside world. I think that certainly is the case. But I think we have heard from many, many people over the years who have told us that different episodes that we have put out have helped them think about the world differently. And I think to that extent, we in some ways are not preaching to the choir. We're actually challenging people's beliefs. One thing I will just say that the show has done for me, because I feel like in many ways, you know, the show is a compendium of all of my own limitations and frailties and neuroses and shortcomings, because I feel like when I look inside my own mind, I sort of see all kinds of ways in which my own behavior deviates from the kind of person that I would like to be. And I'm like, isn't that interesting? Why is it that I think that way? Or why is it that I did that? Or why is it that I'm not a more generous person, even though I know that I should be a more generous person? And I think there's something that comes from understanding why it is we behave the way we do. And I think what it does is it provides us an element of empathy and compassion, not just for other people, but empathy and compassion for ourselves. So we understand that the reason we do things, in fact, are connected perhaps to our deep evolutionary past. They're connected to our social norms, to our social groups. But this empathy and compassion, I think, also gives us now an ability to say, I understand where this is coming from, but I also understand that maybe I have the capacity to change things. I have the capacity to go in a different direction. That certainly is the dream and the hope of Hidden Brain.
You just aired an episode on your podcast about a woman who decided to donate a kidney because of an episode of Hidden Brain. So you know that you are making a difference for people, sometimes in some very profound ways. What do you hear from listeners? What do they tell you about how the show affects them?
You know, I've been surprised in many ways, to be honest, Charity. You know, I feel like the stuff that I'm doing is often, you know, exploring very, you know, geeky academic research and delving very deep into research papers. And of course, we're trying to translate that and make that as accessible as possible. But we're very much a show about science, and that takes science very seriously. And that's also true of the new book, Useful Delusions. It takes science very seriously. I think what I've been struck and moved by is exactly what you said a second ago. Many people will report that they will go back to old episodes of Hidden Brain to sort of see something in the news in a new light. You know, there are two ways of thinking about what it means to be an explorer. You know, I've often, when I was a kid, I thought that being an explorer meant that you traveled to, you know, distant lands and faraway continents, and you travel to places that no one had ever been to before, and you discovered things and saw things that no one had seen before. And that certainly is one kind of exploration. But I've realized there's another kind of exploration that in some ways is both more accessible to everyone, but is also a more profound kind of exploration, which is to interrogate the things that are right around us, to look at them with fresh eyes. You know, I sometimes think about this is what happens when we are tourists. You know, I remember visiting Paris some years ago, and I was struck by the fact that I was visiting Paris for the first time. You know, my eyes were wide open. I was taking in everything. But then I noticed all the people hurrying around me on their way to work. And I realized that for the people in Paris, they were no longer seeing their city with fresh eyes. And I realized that part of what tourism gives you is this ability to look at the things around you with fresh eyes. And in fact, if you brought those very same eyes to your regular life, if in fact you could behave like a tourist as you go through your own life, you would see your own life as being a wonderful, curious, and amazing thing. And I think that's what we've tried to do with Hidden Brain over the years, which is to examine our own lives through the eyes of a tourist, to say, if we examine the very ordinary, everyday things that happen to us, and we look at them with curiosity, we look at them with empathy, we actually can discover whole worlds inside those everyday events, whole worlds that can give us empathy and compassion for ourselves and other people, but also, you know, a way to look at the world that gives us mechanisms to change the world for the better.
Writing about self-delusion at this moment in time, that's where we started the hour. What do you want people to take away as they look around the world and they do see the danger? They do see that, you know, the Capitol was attacked by people who were embracing a lie. Mm-hmm. You talked about harnessing the self-deception for good. But when we look at that, how do you think we should think about it?
I think many of us are so disturbed by delusions and by the content of delusions that we often approach those delusions with head-on arguments, by basically arguing with friends or neighbors or long-ago classmates, and you know, we cannot believe that these people have the views that they believe. I think if we actually approach this differently, we might end up being more successful. if we actually approach this with curiosity and with compassion and with empathy, and I know that's difficult to do because the delusions that we're talking about can be so harmful, but I suspect that if we actually were more pragmatic, if we said, how do we overcome these delusions, we would ask more questions. We would ask people, what would happen if this delusion was taken away from you? What does this delusion mean to you? It's not a guarantee that we would change people's minds, but I suspect we would be far more effective than we currently are.
Shankar Vedantam, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure and a delight to chat with you, Charity.
Shankar Vedantam, he is the host of Hidden Brain, and his latest book is Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. This is Talk of Iowa.
I'm Ben Kiefer. Each day on River to River, we focus on the news, issues, and events that shape our state. We aim to go beyond the headlines, giving listeners access to state legislators, congressmen, and policymakers, and allowing you to discuss the issues and offer ideas and solve problems as well. Join us on River to River, weekdays at noon on Iowa Public Radio.